Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Colin McCann, who is the author of a collection of stories, basically one short novel and three short stories, titled 13 Ways of Looking. Colin McCann is the author of Let the Great World Spin, Transatlantic, Zoli. There are nine books in all. I guess we need to start with what happened on June 27, 2014, because it plays a role in the editing of 13 Ways of Looking and the writing of the other stories. So what happened on that particular day?
So I was about three-quarters of the way through the novella. I had the stories in various shapes and suggestions when I was at a conference for a non-profit organization that I'm the chairperson of. It's called Narrative 4, Story Exchange Organization. I was given the keynote address on empathy, of all things. I was coming back from dinner. I was on my own, and there was an incident on the street where a man was beating a woman on the street. I sort of stepped over and got verbally involved. The situation was sorted. I went back down to my hotel. I was standing outside my hotel, chatting on the telephone with my son, who was in New York at the time. I woke up 2.5 hours later in an MRI machine. So I'd been attacked in the most sort of cowardly way, punched from behind. And I ended up in hospital, on and off in hospital for the next couple of months with various ailments. But mostly I would say it wasn't so much the physical stuff. I had broken teeth and shattered cheekbone and things like that. It was more what I term the punch behind the punch, the emotional impact of this, and trying to understand it and come to terms with it. And I'm not a shrinking violet by any manner or means, but it penetrated hard for me. And I stopped writing. I stopped writing altogether.
You stopped writing the short stories.
Writing the short stories, the novellas, everything. I was sort of paralyzed. And then I got a chance to write the victim impact statement, which I'd never really known before that one could do so. And basically what it means is you just go to court and say what happened to you and what you think should happen to the person who attacked you, who confessed to it. So I spent a couple of days writing that, and suddenly I felt released. It was that cathartic thing. I'd never before believed in the idea of writer's block, but this time I had definitely been blocked. And the ability just to sit back, tell the story, and to contemplate what it was that was going on was a great release for me. So it stepped me back into the stories.
Let's finish that tale a little. So you got knocked out and you woke up 2.5 hours later. How did you find out that the person who attacked you and the nature of the attack, how did you learn about that?
Well, it was seen on the street. It was pretty obvious that it would be this guy because I had a verbal confrontation and they saw him. And I basically told him to leave her that alone. So I felt that I'd done my Boy Scout thing. I helped her up off the ground. He left.
And that was his wife?
And it was his wife, yeah. And he's a big, brutish-looking fella. Looked like a quarterback. And, you know, I wasn't silly enough to step up to him, but he stepped up to me afterwards. In a way, this is my own way of punching back. But mostly what I'm thinking about is, you know, who are those women who constantly have to deal with this sort of thing? Imagine this happening day after day after day and people not stepping up to say anything. I got letters, Richard, from all over the world, hundreds of emails, dozens of letters, very profound and beautiful letters talking about empathy, talking about, you know, silence. I'm reminded of the Algerian poet Tahir Dajout? He says, If you keep quiet, you die. If you speak, you die. So speak and die.
You're already speaking out on issues, Narrative 4, and you know, you've been an activist, so it's not as if your actions are necessarily out of the ordinary, but then again, putting yourself in physical danger is always a different thing from getting up in front of an audience and saying, you know, hey, we got to help people.
I'd do the exact same thing, you know, if I saw it happening today, I'd do the exact same thing, except I'd make one quick change. I would call the cops immediately beforehand, and I probably would have been in a better situation if I'd done so in New Haven. But it doesn't change my way. And I'm recovered now. I just got a text from a doctor friend of mine whom I run with in New York, literally just 10 minutes ago before we stepped into the studio, and he said, you have healed yourself, because he read the stories, and he understood that the stories deeply relate to you know, dealing with trauma and forgiveness and these sort of things.
In particular, the story, the last story in the book, which is Treaty, which we'll get into in a few minutes. But I've been thinking a lot about the nature of forgiveness, particularly when you're angry at somebody. And I was talking to a psychiatrist, and he said he hates the word forgiveness.
Hmm.
And what he said, and I relate this because in your victim statement, which can be found at colinmccann.com, you have a line, "I have forgiven my attacker, but I will never excuse him."
Mm.
And what the psychiatrist said is, he said, forgiveness is weird. We don't really forgive. We sort of have to accept.
Mm-hmm.
And he used the word acceptance rather than the word forgiveness, because if we pretend and say, okay, I forgive you, that anger might still sit inside of us.
I like that idea. I like the idea of acceptance. But the most important thing here is not to seek revenge. And I think that's part of forgiveness is about, and not turning justice into revenge. I mean, we still have to look for justice within that system. So I say acceptance, I deal with that. I would agree with them. Yeah. This is really important. I do not excuse those sort of actions, just like I don't excuse an awful lot of other actions of people that go on. He needed to be tattooed with it. He needed to know that he had in no way any right to do any of the things that he's doing, particularly to his wife, in fact, in the middle of a public street, beating her. I mean, come on.
His claim was he was a first-time offender subject to rehabilitation.
Yeah.
I mean, really.
Yeah, baloney. Absolute baloney.
He had 2.5 years suspended sentence, 3 years probation. Are you satisfied with that?
Super satisfied. I actually called for him not to go to prison. So in my statement, I said, please do not send him to prison. I don't think the prison system does any good for people like that. And for him to get probation then, because if he does it again and if he gets caught, he definitely goes down. In the end, he served 3 weeks in prison because the judge found out that he had 3 weeks vacation from his job. And she said, okay, you're going to spend your 3 weeks in prison. And be thankful because the person who you assaulted called for you not to go to prison. Otherwise, she said, she would have sent him to prison.
You have had no contact with him since?
No, don't want to.
Or the wife?
Don't want to.
Colin McCann, let's go back then to these stories. Now, the first story, was that always going to be a novella? 13 Ways of Looking.
No, actually, it was going to be a novel at one stage, and I had it written from 13 different points of view, and it was a structural mess, really, but it was too conscious, it was too divisive, and I didn't like it, and the only voice I liked within the novel draft was the voice of the character who remains there, Mendelssohn. The interesting thing being, for example, I was trying to write a cop character, and I realized how difficult it is to actually write a good cop. Because no matter what I did, even though it was video forensic, it turned into cliche. I have enormous respect for the likes of, say, Richard Price. What Richard can do in creating these characters and keep them away from cliche is absolutely extraordinary to me. You know, as a writer, you have to acknowledge your failures, and you have to acknowledge your weaknesses, too. And that was one of my weaknesses, but I enjoyed the voice of the retired judge. So stories find their own length, you know, they do. You can't shoehorn them into. My publishers in England, they really wanted me to accordion the story out, just another 30 pages, and call it a novel and sell it as a novel. That didn't feel truthful, didn't feel honest. I wanted to leave it as a novella.
The story of it parallels what happened to you in a way.
Mm.
But that came before.
It's weird. It's like fiction preceding reality and then reality itself putting a map on the fiction so that afterwards when I'm editing and thinking about what it is the stories want to say, it is informed by the stuff that happened to me or happened to, you know, hundreds of other people in those letters who sort of communicated with me. Yeah, it's a little bit freaky. You know, I was working on this and then a similar sort of thing happened to me. I suppose we could shape much of our lives in that way.
Is your wife Jewish? Just curious.
No.
Because there's a lot of Jewish-Irish mix in the book.
We're the lost tribe. I don't know why. It just felt right. Of course, the greatest character in literature, certainly in contemporary literature, is the Irish-Hungarian Jew Leopold Bloom. You know, there are certainly echoes of Leopold Bloom in my character Mendelssohn, but I have no family affiliation with a Jewish background. But I am going to Israel next month, which will be an interesting trip given what's going on there right now. I'm fascinated by that part of the world, possibly because, You know, I wrote a novel, Transatlantic, which was primarily about the peace process in Northern Ireland. Everybody said that after 700 years, it would be impossible for anyone to achieve peace. Under the guidance, the sort of musical conduction of Senator George Mitchell, we came to a peace agreement, which is more or less held solid now for 17 years. He went to the Middle East. He couldn't achieve anything. I'm sort of fascinated by that, and I want to go there and have a look at that area myself.
13 ways of looking. So there were originally 13 different points of view. Yeah. There's Mendelssohn, I assume, the housekeeper,
exactly,
the
seven.
Son
exactly.
is three, the yeah. cop is four, right. the owner of the restaurant is five.
Exactly, and the perpetrator then, and the perpetrator's daughter. And but here's the problem. I think if you write towards a boxed structure, you lose some of the mystery, you lose some of the magic. In other words, I had planned it out beforehand. I know there are loads of writers who plan out their novels and know exactly where they're going. I can't do that. I have to be like an explorer rather than a traveler. A traveler knows where she or he is going. An explorer gets out there and has no idea where it happened to be going. And so part of me was bored with the structure and thinking, oh my gosh, okay, now I have to do this. It became inevitable. And I don't like that inevitability about fiction.
And that happened before the incident.
That's right.
So you were already getting bogged down. You loved Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn's a
yeah.
great character. But you suddenly looked and went, what am I doing here? Which
right.
meant that more than likely the book would not have been completed as you thought it would be, no matter what.
No matter what. No matter what. So focusing in on this one character seemed like the proper way to go. And I like the idea of a novella, too. I mean, it's a tough length to sort of sell to people, but it sort of sits between that imploding universe of the short story and the exploding universe of the novel.
When I was speaking with Paul Theroux recently, and we were talking about short stories, and for some reason I'm interviewing a lot of people who've been writing short stories. He said that one of the big differences between writing a novel and a short story, I use the word payoff. Mm. There's got to be payoff in a novel. He said, well, the thing about a short story is it's usually a mood, an idea, and it doesn't have to have that payoff at the end. I would think a novella, though, does.
A novella sort of has to have. One of the big differences for me is that novels can make mistakes. Short stories cannot make mistakes.
What do you consider a mistake?
Going off on a tangent. A reader will forgive you for going off on a tangent for 20, 30 pages, as long as you've already whispered, listen, trust me, I will bring you somewhere. This is going to pay off, as you say. With a short story, it's so much more carved and sort of poetry. I'm not valuing one over the other. I don't think short stories are better than novels or vice versa. In fact, I don't think poems are better than short stories or anything. But I do think that it is a different form of engagement. It's like somebody called short stories the chamber music of literature. Whenever I write a short story, I want it to have the same sort of emotional payoff as a novel. I want the reader to come out of it and their world to be just slightly shifted in whatever way to allow them a space to go into somewhere new.
It seemed to me that the Mendelssohn voice almost wrote itself.
You're right, it did. There's so much of myself in there. Also, the Mendelssohn character is 82 years old. My father was 85 years old. My father passed away this February. He got to read the piece before he died. His mind was still very, very sharp, right up until the end. He laughed about it. You know, he's an Irish Catholic. Obviously, Mendelssohn is from Lithuania and lives in New York and so on, but has a little bit of an Irish accent to him. Yeah, I was in my own head and in my dad's head, and there's lots of puns and there's lots of wordplay and there's lots of crazy associations, and he makes these shotgun leaps through. You're in his consciousness for a good deal of the novella. And thankfully, because all this stuff is grim, for me, he was a funny character, and he can be humorous at times and bring a smile to my face. Because, you know what, in the end, let's face it, writing has to be a form of entertainment as well. I'm not talking about making people go, you know, bellyache or anything like that, but I do think we have to entertain.
You're listening to an interview with Colin McCann, whose latest book is 13 Ways of Looking. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. Colin McCann, let's talk about those other stories. So you come out of the hospital, you're stuck. Had either of those other three stories been in the back of your mind? Did they not exist at all at that point?
There's three stories. One is Shokol, another one is What Time Is It Now, Where You Are, and the other one is a story called Treaty. None of Treaty had been written. What Time Is It Now, Where You Are had been drafted and done beforehand. Shokol was sort of halfway through. Obviously, the editing of these was influenced by the stuff that had happened to me.
What Time Is It struck me as a story that you sort of wanted to write and then kind of realized, well, maybe the only thing to do is to write my process.
Yeah. You know, I hate metafiction. And if you'd have talked to me 2 years ago and said, you're going to write a story where you yourself are a character in the story, I'd say you're out of your mind. I mean, there are certain people who do it beautifully, like Sasha Alexander Heyman does it beautifully, and I have great admiration for him, or Barth or Barthelme, or, you know, a number of people do it very, very well. I thought I'd never, ever be able to do it. And then, lo and behold, here I am, presented with a dilemma, and I start to become a character in my own fiction. The story is about the expansiveness of fiction. So I start out from a very, very limited image of a young female Marine in Afghanistan, and I'm trying to imagine what her life is. Why is she sitting in a rocky outpost on New Year's Eve? What is her life like? And then suddenly, as I start to investigate her, all these questions come up, and her life gets layered and bigger and bigger and bigger, till at the end, honestly, I think I could have written a novel based on what was happening. It was kind of a wonderful process. I'm in and out of the story as a character myself. Mostly, I want to get rid of myself. I really don't want to hang around in my fiction.
What do you think was the difference in the editing on that particular story because of what you'd gone through?
Wow, I'm not really sure. The degree of consciousness of self, I was able to accept it. You know, I've always wanted to sort of hide away, hide in the shadows, to sort of pretend that I have nothing absolute to say. There's nothing worse than a writer who wears her or his politics on their sleeve. But this time round, I wasn't scared of it at all. Okay, the fact of the matter is, and I haven't said this to anybody, but the doctors told me that I was very, very, very lucky to be around, and that I could have been damaged. I could have had some serious brain damage. And that sort of haunts me, because what would have happened if I'd been around and not been able to write these stories anymore? So there was a liberation in that as well, and being able to talk. Say, okay, I can talk about myself now. I'm here. I'm around.
You kind of just blew off any reservations you had about the story at that point.
Yeah.
And Shokol, which is about a woman and her son in Ireland. And again, I can sort of see elements where it might have been affected, but if the plot was already in your head, then that wasn't the change.
That wasn't the change. The editing was the change. So Shokol, which is a Hebrew word for a parent who has lost a child, both as a noun and an adjective, because we have no word in English for a parent who's lost a child, which is freaky to me. And in lots of different languages, in fact, I don't know why. We have widow, we have widower, we have orphan, we have all these things, but we have no specific term for a parent who's lost a child. I suppose I shouldn't say this, but it's possibly my favorite story in the collection. It's about an Irish woman from a Jewish background who lives in the Gaeltacht, which is the Irish-speaking area, the west of Ireland, and she has adopted a Russian son who has fetal alcohol syndrome, and he goes missing when she takes him swimming one day. The story sort of develops from there. That came out of wanting to write about this word. Literally, the story came from a word itself, and who knows where the characters are. I honestly don't know where the characters come from. You sort of mess around, you start to write, and then you retreat, and then you write again, and it's like, you know, the process, I've described it before, is like, you know, dipping into a well. You know, you lower that bucket down into the well, finally you hit water with that jolt, and then you start to wind the water up, and you do it over and over and over again.
And now we'll get to the final story. The story that clearly came afterward, because it is about, I think it's not about forgiveness, I think it's about acceptance, is the word that I would use.
I like that term. I'm going to juggle that term now and see. It was a psychologist or a psychiatrist?
Psychiatrist
is correct, because possibly he or she is, he's probably correct.
As I was reading the story, and I read the last few pages more than once, It's the story of a nun who has been beaten and is dealing with the trauma for many years, and she stumbles across her tormentor and has to deal with this. And then she goes to confront him. I think in a short story we can kind of tell that, because that's just, you know, the clothesline. And
right.
It's the clothes that count.
Exactly.
For some reason, as I kept reading it, she got her acceptance at that moment. She got her satisfaction. And I kept thinking, why? Why, when he hasn't changed, is it simply because he recognized her?
It's simply because she says to him, I still exist. I am here. You haven't destroyed me. You know, part of what I was dealing with was that I wanted to hide away from the world. And my trauma was very small in comparison to trauma that hundreds and millions of people in this country suffer all the time. But a lot of the time we just retreat away from it and we just let it eat away at our soul. Part of the recovery for me is to be able to stand up here and to say that, and to hopefully allow other people to say that at the same time too. For her, this Irish nun, she's a radical nun. She was in South America, and then she sees her attacker on the television 37 years later in London. She goes to a conference to confront him. And it's simply by saying, I am here, I exist, you did not beat me, that her sort of, her great moment of satori comes about, her acceptance, as you say.
Colin McCann, this is a weird question. I could never write that story if that had happened to me, because the emotion would be too great. How did it feel being in the nun's habit yourself, writing it?
I worked and crafted those last couple of pages over and over and over again, because you don't want them to be too conscious of yourself, and yet you know that this idea of biography and autobiography is very, very interesting to me. If I sat down to write my own story, which I kind of did in my victim impact statement, I'd get so far. But I think I get much, much deeper by imagining a character. In other words, I think that fiction, as we traditionally call it, achieves a greater depth, a greater honesty, because it's not aware of its own absolute provenance. It comes from somewhere deep, mysterious, and layered. And to me, you know, that was the fun part. I know I was talking about myself. I know I was. But I gave the story to her.
Her brother, who wants to out this guy as a monster. There were people, I guess, in your life who basically told you, this guy's a monster, he needs to go to prison.
Yes, absolutely. People who were very close to me, in fact. Some of them were a little bit upset at me for saying, I don't think this guy should go to jail. But I didn't want to be responsible for, you know, someone going to jail, to have that sort of guilt hanging over me. You know, I've seen that system. I used to work with juvenile delinquents in Texas many, many years ago. They used to talk to me about what went on in juvie. And then I met some of them years later who actually went to prison. In fact, there's one kid, he threatened a president. I don't want to identify him. Let's say he threatened a president online and did it as a joke. Wonderful kid. I really liked him. He got arrested. He got charged. He went to prison. In prison, he got beaten repeatedly over and over and over again until it got so bad for him that he actually put batteries in a sock one day and attacked one of his attackers. And then he got an extended sentence after that. And that sort of story haunted me. He should never have been in prison in the first place. And our prison system, as we know, is so mucked up. I mean, we're putting more people in prison than any other country in the world. Let's look at recovery in a different sort of way. And let's start telling stories. And let's start negotiating our experience through being able to stand up there and to talk about it. We've become so isolated. And this is where I think literature matters. Literature matters. And I know I'm wearing my heart on my sleeve in relation to that. But it's all that I can say. And it's all that I really want to say. I'm not being sentimental about it. But I am being full of sentiment and a certain amount of anger by saying, unless we learn to tell our stories and the stories of others, which is what I do through that organization, Narrative 4. Unless we do this, we're in serious trouble.
Colin McCann, the words that you use about Narrative 4 is radical empathy. You got slammed in the face with how do you deal with radical empathy, and I kept thinking about that in terms of angers I've had,
right.
Which is how do we step outside of that and come to terms with we're not going to eliminate the anger, but how do we come to terms with it and deal with it and move past it?
That's the thing. I mean, first of all, I didn't want any of this stuff to get out. But then an Irish newspaper found out about it, and then they doorstepped me and wanted to take photos when my head was about the size of three pumpkins. So I realized I had to make a statement about it. And then it went out on the wire, and then the New York Times did a piece. And the New York Times, which is a paper I like very much, but they did a headline, it's like, author known for his empathy has none for his attacker. And this is like a couple of days afterwards. And damn right I didn't have any empathy for my attacker at that stage. I had empathy for his wife, who was the one who was being attacked. So I had to deal with, how do I think about him? How do I finally try to understand, or as you say, to accept? What we do at Narrative 4 is we bring kids from all over the world together. So we have kids from Limerick, kids from Rwanda, kids from Mexico, from the south side of Chicago, from Connecticut, all over. And what they do is they step into one another's shoes. They tell one another stories. So I will talk with you in a group and you will talk with me. I'll give you a valuable story, something that happened to me. And I'll get up and say, hi, my name is Richard. And when I was in Berkeley, and tell that story. What's amazing about that is it's a double thing. I get to tell a story, but I also get to tell somebody else's story. And suddenly the lungs of the world are so much bigger. It's like you expand them in extraordinary ways. And people's consciousness of what it means to be someone else is sort of shifted and changed. And that's why we call it Narrative 4 with the numeral 4. So it's a Narrative 4 piece, a narrative for the environment, a narrative for Ireland, a narrative for Berkeley, whatever it happens to be. So we're a story exchange organization, and we put it in schools as well.
Well, I keep thinking that if you could find a way to connect that up with acting, where you're basically taking on another person and becoming
right.
another person.
Yeah, absolutely. I think originally the whole process comes from acting school classes, except we're dealing with real stories, the real world, how people listen to our stories. And let's not forget, stories are not these airy-fairy things. It drives me nuts when people start talking about stories as some sort of soft, new-agey sort of thing. Stories are muscular. Stories are hard. Stories can send our kids to war. Stories can do all sorts of things. After food, after a roof, and maybe family or whatever it happens to be, one of the most important things is our ability to tell our story. And you think about like how cultures get, or how governments and police states, they cut us off. They do not allow us to tell our story. That's one of the most important things for those governments.
Well, there's a story in the New York Times about in Belarus, they've blocked theaters from certain plays, and now they hold them in people's houses for free.
That's fantastic. And that reminds me of the scene in Michael Ondaatje's In the Skin of a Lion, when all the immigrants are coming across and they're learning English by going to the theater. And then one day, one of the actors, I think, drops dead on stage, and one of the immigrants steps up and in perfect English delivers all the lines for the play. Yeah, they will take away your voice. They will take away your voice. They will take away your story. What we have to learn to do is to take it back. We've got to reclaim that territory, no matter how anonymous it happens to be. I'm talking about little backyard things as much as anything else, the local being the universal.
You did a documentary called Bystander Revolution. What was that?
Oh, yeah, that's the thing by Mackenzie Bezos. She has this anti-bullying initiative where she gets people from sort of all around the world to, she just wants to make a stand against bullying. They interviewed me for it and put it online. There's so many good initiatives out there, so many things like non-profit organizations, and they sort of get unsung. I never forget that we're just doing good work. You know, people are not getting paid for this sort of stuff. You know, they're not making a profit off of it.
Colin McCann, you know, we talked a little before about Northern Ireland. There seems to be some kind of increase in the violence up there now. What's going on?
Oh, Lord, yes. All of this stuff is economic. Some of the politics is in danger of falling apart. But there's been so much good stuff going on in Northern Ireland for the past 17 years that we have to recognize it's more than worth saving. Any step back into violence is going to be a serious, serious, serious problem, I think, for all of us. Yeah, there have been a couple of killings, but they're mostly mostly non-sectarian killings. And let's not forget that just 20 years ago, there were bombs going off. There were people being tarred and feathered. There were people being shot in the street, kidnapped, and so on. None of that is really happening anymore. I think that what we need to do is need to go in, and all peace comes down to, in so many cases, comes down to economy. Part of it is that the Irish government and the British government have to put more money into Northern Ireland and give people jobs, and so it's very simple.
Did you see The Walk?
Haven't seen it yet.
Neither have I. Speaking of that, has Hollywood come to you at all for any of your stories or novels?
Yeah, actually, I'm working with J.J. Abrams on adapting Let the Great World Spin. It's done. I don't know what's going to happen. Hopefully it'll happen within the next year or two. But don't hold your breath. I'm certainly not holding my breath. I really like working with J.J. He's a fascinating character. I've done a few bits and pieces. I did a short film called Everything in This Country Must. I always remember because I went to the Oscars on the night of my 40th birthday. So it's over 10 years ago. That was a fun thing. It was directed by an Irish guy called Gary McKendry. I think he did a beautiful job. It's actually on my website. If they want to watch his film, they can go to the website. He got nominated for an Oscar for it. And that was... Listen, it's a miracle sometimes if a good story gets written, but it's a true, true, true miracle if a good film gets made. Because you've got so many things going on, right? You know, all the money, all the actors, all the weather, all the, you know, the electricians, what, you know, insurance clauses, all these things. And then, of course, the director and the actors themselves. So when a good film gets made, I think it's always fantastic.
Two questions, Colin McCann. The first, have you ever thought about writing plays?
Yes, I've thought about writing plays, and you know what? I wish I could write a play. Every time I go to the theatre, I come out thinking, I'm going to write a play. And I've tried it a couple of times, and the first act is always wonderful. I think, this is so easy, this is fantastic. And then I get towards the second act, and I realise that I've thrown about 15 different balls up in the air, and I'm trying to juggle them all, and suddenly I get frozen, and they all start to crash down to the ground. I think writing plays is a fantastic skill, which I don't have. I don't know how to resolve the second act issues. You know, someday maybe I'll give it another bash, but I have great respect for those playwrights. But if I could, I would like to write a play. Maybe even write a musical, because I have great respect for musicians. Did you see Sting's musical?
No, I didn't.
Oh, it was fantastic. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. I'd love to work with someone like him and come up with a musical at some stage.
I spoke not too long ago with a guy named Craig Lucas, who has written several librettos, including An American in Paris, which is in New York now, Amelie here at Berkeley Rep, and a really great show called Light in the Piazza. And he said that writing the libretto for a musical is harder than any other thing he's ever done.
Well, it doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me. You've got all the elements of, like, traditional theater, and then you've got to get the music right and the temperature right. And then, of course, it's almost like making a film because so much money goes into it, especially if these things go to Broadway. Well, I wrote a play once, Flaherty's Window, which was god-awful, but it played off Broadway. It was sort of unresolved, but I enjoyed the experience, the collaborative thing with the actors.
Colin McCann, are you working on another novel now?
As I said, I'm going to Israel, I'm going to the West Bank, and I'm hoping to set something over there. It'll be an Irish, Palestinian, Israeli novel. A good friend of mine who founded a group called Telos, which is a fantastic group that brings people over to Israel and the West Bank. He says, in the most extraordinary way, he's Palestinian-American, and he says, I'm pro-Israeli. And then he stops. Right? And then he says, I'm pro-Palestinian too. And I'm pro-peace. And I like that notion. And I'm going to try and achieve something that talks about all that darkness over there and try and make sense of it for myself. And if I can make sense of it for myself, maybe I can make sense of it for some other people. It will be the most extraordinary, difficult novel that I'm going to take on, but I'm going to take it on.
You've been listening to an interview with Colin McCann, whose latest book is 13 Ways of Looking. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.